Well, good morning. It's good to be with all of you. My name is Michael. I'm the director of discipleship here at Faithbridge. And whether you are here in our live service this morning, or you're in our communion service, or you're watching online, we are really glad that you're here with us today. I went on my first backpacking trip in the wilderness when I was 12 years old with my little brother Kyle, my grandpa, a couple uncles, and a cousin. And this trip was a lot of things. This was a coming-of-age trip. It was a rite of passage. It was a little bit of a hazing ritual. But above all else, this was going to be a man's trip, and we were going to do man things. And that's what we did. We hiked into the wilderness in Colorado. We fished in alpine lakes. We learned to clean the fish that we caught in those alpine lakes. We learned how to relieve ourselves outside, how to read a map and a compass, how to ignore our uncle's deafening snores in the sleeping bags next to us. It was awesome. But the best thing that we did the entire trip was learn how to make fire. And so I remember when my uncle called us over the first night and he taught us how to make a fire just from the normal things lying around. How you could take pine needles and leaves and put them in a little fire circle with rocks all around. You make a teepee out of twigs. You get that going and then you put branches around the twigs and then logs around the branches. And before you know it, you've got a blazing fire. And Kyle and I were fascinated by this. And so we started to play with the fire. And we poked the fire, and we would take branches and we would hold them in the fire until they lit. And then we would swing them around at each other like lightsabers. And at that point, my uncle looked at us, and for the first time that trip, he told us to cut it out. And I don't think it's because he was concerned for our safety. He had not shown a whole lot of concern for our safety that trip. Again, this was a man's trip. Safety was not priority one. But he called us over and he explained how when you're in the backcountry and you've got a fire, you have to keep the fire in the circle because otherwise the fire might catch and get out of control. So if you're going to have a fire, you've got to manage it carefully and then extinguish it completely when you're finished. Otherwise, it might hurt you or it might hurt other people. I tell this story because today we're going to be in 1 Corinthians 6 as we continue our series that we're calling Healthy Church. And in 1 Corinthians 6, Paul is going to talk about conflict in a very similar way to the way that my uncle talks to us about fire. That conflict, when it springs up, when it pops up, if we're not keeping it in the circle, if we're not managing it and extinguishing it as fast as we can, it might get out of control and hurt you or hurt other people that you love. This is where 1 Corinthians has been going up until this point. If you were with us last week, we were in 1 Corinthians 1, where Paul acknowledged that conflict is happening in the Corinthian church, but before he addresses the conflict itself, he addresses the two underlying causes of conflict in the church. That there are people in the church who believe that their life is all about going up and to the right, and there are people who believe that life is just about their way or the highway. And so over the course of chapters 1-5, Paul spends that time untangling the problem with that way of thinking and how that's not what the cross shows, and therefore that's not how Christians are supposed to live. And then when we get to chapter 6, Paul begins what I call the laundry list portion of the letter, where he is now going to finally address all of the things that the Corinthians are fighting about, and he's going to start by talking about interpersonal conflict. And he's going to start here because he knows that we all have interpersonal conflict and that we've had it since we were very young, especially if you have siblings. My parents tell a story about a time when I was 4 years old and I was watching Barney very innocently in the living room. And my little brother Kyle, who was 2 at the time, had just learned to walk. He came up behind me with a metal car in his hand. And as I'm sitting there doing nothing, apropos of nothing, Kyle hits me over the head as hard as he can with the car. And I collapsed into a screaming heap, and Kyle walked away as cool as a mafia hitman. I had conflict when I was 4 years old. And the problem is we don't ever grow out of conflict. We just kind of grow up with it. And silly fights with siblings turn into angst with your parents when you're a teenager. That turns into trying to navigate tricky friendships as you get older. And by the time you're an adult, there are times when we wake up and it kind of feels like our whole life is defined by conflict. That you're in a marriage that once was great, but now it kind of feels like you fight about every little thing. You can't go to the grocery store without fighting. Your life feels like it's defined by conflict. Or you've got an overbearing family member, and no matter how many boundaries you've set, they keep overstepping that boundary, and now you're wondering whether you need to go no contact. Your life is consumed by conflict. Or maybe you once had a friendship that was great, but then through a bizarre series of miscommunications, all of a sudden that friendship has fizzled out, and you don't know what that friend even thinks of you anymore. You have conflict. And so the question then is not if conflict is going to come, it's when conflict is going to come. And when conflict comes, what we've got to ask is, what do we do? How do we handle it? When conflict comes, how do we address it and handle it wisely as believers and as a healthy church? This is what Paul wants to talk to us today. We're going to be in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, starting in verse 1. If you need a Bible, you can raise your hand. The ushers would be happy to bring you one, and you can keep that if you would like. That's our gifts to you this morning. 1 Corinthians chapter 6, verse 1 says this: when one of you has a grievance against another, does he dare go to law before the unrighteous instead of the saints? And so in verse 1, Paul tells us what kind of conflict we're dealing with. We are dealing with civil interpersonal conflict. What we're not dealing with is criminal conflict. So we're not dealing with situations, and we know this based on words that Paul uses here for grievance and cases later on. We're not dealing with situations where someone is physically harming you or putting you in physical danger. If that's the kind of conflict you're in right now, Paul would say in Romans 13, that the government does not bear the sword in vain. And you probably need to take that to the state and get some protection from the state so that you can be protected and taken care of even as you try to solve that conflict. So that's not what we're talking about today. Instead, we're talking about interpersonal conflict. Things are popping up in the Corinthian church and they're taking it outside of the church. And I don't know if you could tell, but Paul is mad about this. That word dare that we read earlier, that word is actually the first word in verse 1. So that the sense of this verse is, how dare you? How dare you, when one of you has a grievance against another, that you bring it before unbelievers instead of the saints? There's anger here. And Paul is angry because the Corinthians are taking conflict, which starts in the context of relationships and starts in the context of the church, and they are removing it from that circle and they are bringing it before those who have no business knowing about the conflict or taking care of the conflict. And so what Paul is going to start to say to us about conflict is this: that when conflict comes, we've got to keep it in the circle, because otherwise it might get out of control and it might hurt us in a way that we didn't even see coming. We have a word for this when conflict is taken outside of the circle where it started, and it's called gossip. You probably have witnessed gossip. You've seen what gossip can do to a friend group when it runs through that friend group. You may have experienced gossip yourself. That when people start talking about you, all of a sudden you spend the next week of your life cross-examining your friends and family members, trying to figure out what they're saying about you, trying to figure out what the damage is to your reputation, where it came from, who's saying that. Gossip is exhausting and it's destructive. And I bet you know that. But you know what's interesting? I have people in my office throughout the week who want to confess all sorts of things and wrestle through all sorts of things and talk through all sorts of things. Sometimes they want to talk about gossip and their friend groups and drama and the way that gossip is affecting them. Do you know how many times someone has come to me and told me that they are struggling with being a gossip? Zero. No one has ever told me that. And isn't that interesting? That we're all nodding along when I say, yeah, you've seen gossip, you've seen the destruction of it, you've experienced it, but mysteriously, we can't find the person who's doing it. You would not raise your hand and say, you're the problem. And I think the reason for that, I think there may be a couple of reasons for that. I think one of them might be that we are more a part of gossip and surrounded by gossip than we would care to think. It reminds me of this parable that the author David Foster Wallace told in a speech that he gave one time. He said that there are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, "Morning, boys, how's the water?" And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over at the other and goes, "What the heck is water?" And so the fish are not able to recognize water because they're immersed in it. And I just wonder if we're not able to recognize gossip because we're so immersed in it. This is true at least sociologically. There have been a lot of studies on gossip in the United States, and depending on the one that you read, anywhere between 50% and 85% of casual conversation among friends in the United States is either adjacent to gossip or is gossip itself. We're surrounded by this. And it doesn't help that we call it different things than it actually is when we're doing it. I wonder if you've heard this. It's not gossip because I'm just venting. It's not gossip, I'm just processing. It's not gossip, I'm just getting advice. It's not gossip, I'm just looping someone else in. Now, do you sometimes need to get advice? Yes. Do you sometimes need to loop someone else in? Yes. I'm just not sure that's what we're always doing when we say that's what we're doing. Gossip, by its very definition, is sharing unauthorized information about a person or their conflict with people who have no business knowing it. And so let's play it out. If you've got some friends who are fighting and you go to some other friends who aren't going to end the conflict and you tell them about the conflict, that's gossip. If you're in a conflict and you're calling up someone to talk about it, to vent about it, but they're not in a position to solve it, that's probably gossip. Or if you're in a conflict and you go to some friends in order to hear justification and affirmation and maybe even get that delicious sensation of being the wronged party in the right, that is gossip. And Paul is looking at this and he is saying, we've got to stop. When conflict comes outside of the circle, when gossip starts going, we've got to take it and we've got to put it back in the circle and we've got to stomp it out. Nothing will take a healthy church to an unhealthy church faster than uncontrolled gossip. Nothing will corrode the iron bonds of trust faster than the rust of gossip. It's why we say at FaithBridge, of our 7 core values, we say that we are a gossip-free zone because we know this. And when we say this, this is straight from our website. You can go and look this up later on. We say that FaithBridge is a gossip-free zone, meaning that we work to protect the unity that Christ sought for his followers as demonstrated by valuing one another, protecting reputations, and destroying gossip. Destroying it, not ignoring it, not picking it up with our glass and taking it outside and putting it outside like Elizabeth likes me to do when we find a bug in our house. No, destroying it, stomping it out, extinguishing it. And here's the thing, Paul's not just talking to me and to Pastor Ken and to the other leaders of FaithBridge. He's talking to all of us. We all have a duty to keep conflict in the circle, which means we all have a duty to stomp out gossip when we see it and where we see it. It's a little bit like Smokey the Bear. What does Smokey the Bear say? Only firefighters can prevent wildfires. No, Smokey says only you can prevent wildfires. And only you can prevent gossip. You are all, if you are here in our live service or watching our line or online or in our communion service, you are a part of the gossip destruction team at FaithBridge. And what that means is that your job is, you guessed it, to destroy gossip when you see it and where you see it. Because that is the only way that we will be a healthy enough church so that when people come in, regardless of what's happening outside this church, they feel safe and free to pursue Jesus, to make mistakes, to repent, to go back to Jesus without worrying that people are chirping about them or talking about their reputation. And so you have got to stomp out gossip. You've got to get awkward with it. If people start gossiping around you, in your table group, and your grow group, and the atrium, you tell them we're not gonna have that conversation. Or if you don't wanna do that, you change the subject. You start talking about construction on the Grand Parkway. I promise you, people are gonna start talking about that. But the point is that we've got to destroy gossip. We've got to put it to death. We've got to keep conflict in the circle. And the easiest way that we can destroy gossip is by taking care of conflict when it pops up in our own lives. This is where Paul's gonna go next. When conflict comes, take care of it. Look with me at verse 2. Or do you not know that the saints will judge the world? And if the world is to be judged by you, are you incompetent to try trivial cases? Do you not know that we are to judge angels? How much more then matters pertaining to this life? So if you have such cases, why do you lay them before those who have no standing in the church? I say this to your shame. Can it be that there is no one among you wise enough to settle a dispute between the brothers, but brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers? And so we get a little bit more insight into what Paul is angry about. He's not just angry that conflict is leaving the circle. He's angry that people are not taking care of the conflict within the circle. That when conflict's popping up, individuals aren't taking care of it with each other. And when that's not working, that the church is not taking care of it alongside the individuals. And in order to make his point, Paul starts talking about the saints judging the world and the believers judging angels. What? What on earth does this have to do with conflict? Why is Paul bringing this up? Yeah, it is a little bit confusing, but this is something that Paul sometimes does. He's gonna do it again in 1 Corinthians 11, 1 Corinthians 13, and 1 Corinthians 15, where he sometimes looks to the future of the believer in order to inform what the believer should be doing now. And so what Paul is saying is that in the future, when you and I are in heaven around the throne of Jesus, we're not just gonna be sitting around. We're going to have a job. And that job is to participate in the rule and reign of Jesus over the new heavens and the new earth. And part of that participation will mean, in some capacity, being a part of the way that God judges the world and that God judges angels, probably meaning fallen angels or demons. And so Paul's looking at that. And he's saying, if God is going to trust you to do that because you've got wisdom and you've got peace and you've got the Holy Spirit living inside of you, how is it possible that you are not able to deal with conflict and to take care of it when it's popping up among you? And to that, I would raise my hand and I would say, oh, well, Paul, I have the answer. It's because in the year 2026, we all hate conflict. Many of us are afraid of it. We don't want anything to do with it. When conflict comes up, we break out in hives. This is at least how I feel. That when conflict breaks up in my friend group or in my ministry, my first inclination is to do the same thing that I do when the check engine light pops up on my car. I'm just gonna keep driving, ignore it, baby. I'm gonna hope it solves itself. But that never happens. The car never solves itself. And conflict never, ever solves itself like that. On the contrary, when you start to ignore conflict, you're going to push yourself further away from the other person because things are going to start happening in your heart. Even if it starts small, you're going to find yourself thinking about that conflict more and more. And then when you're driving around, you're going to find that you're daydreaming about it. And then you're going to find that you're having angry dreams about that person. And then you're gonna take your showers and you're gonna be cooking up speeches that would leave that person crying in the corner because you're not dealing with the conflict. And so it's pushing you further away from the other person. Here's the thing, ignoring conflict is not a solution to conflict. Ignoring conflict is never going to solve conflict. I had to learn this the hard way. When I was in college at Rice, I started the Rice mock trial team. And if you don't know, mock trial is a mix between theater and debate. I was really cool. In my senior year, I was the president of this club, the coolest of the cool. And on the team were two guys that I knew really well and loved a lot. One was named Jay and the other was named M. That's what we'll call them. Jay was someone that I had discipled. I had kind of brought him over to Christianity. M was one of my freshmen when I was a junior in my orientation group. I'd helped him get the lay of the land of Rice. So I knew both of them really well. I loved both of them a lot. The problem is both of them hated each other. And there was no real reason for it. There wasn't anything that had like happened. Their personalities just didn't mesh. And so over time, that got worse and worse. There was one perceived slight after another. And then they started actively kind of sabotaging each other and seeking to push the other one down. Each one would come to me individually and would tell me, hey, M is toxic. We've got to get him out. Hey, Jay is a problem. We've got to push him out of the club. They both led sub-teams within the club, and those sub-teams were growing to hate each other because of their toxicity. And you know what I did about this? I did nothing. I was so terrified of making a decision that would have people hate me or not like me that I didn't want to get involved in it at all. So when they would come to me, I would laugh it off, and I would keep going, hoping that in some way, somehow, they would just suddenly grow up and get mature enough that they put the conflict behind them. But this, of course, did not happen. And in the middle of my senior year, Jay finally kind of filed a formal disciplinary complaint against M within the club, which meant that our leadership team had to get together and we heard Jay's side of the story and M's side of the story. And then we voted on whether we were going to kick M out. And as the president, I had the last vote. And so each person on the team or in the leadership team voted one by one. And by the time the vote got to me, it was tied, 3-3. And so now I had spent all year running from having to make a decision and running from having to deal with it. But now I couldn't run from it. Now I had to make a decision. And as I was sitting there, I thought, you know what? This is such a weird situation. We're not kicking anyone out. Maybe we can take care of it. And so I voted not to kick him out. And Jay exploded. And he spent the rest of my senior year, he made it his personal mission to make my life miserable. He had his friends post on Twitter about me, just lies, slander, things that weren't true. He would tell me that he hated me every time he saw me. He and his little sub team would come to my dorm in the middle of the night. They would bang on the doors, and when I would open it, they would all tell me what a horrible person I was. And I was engaged to Elizabeth, and when I was with her, I would just cry and cry and cry because it was so painful that people were upset with me. It was painful to me that people were fighting each other. But mostly because I realized that this conflict was no longer something that I could control. It had gotten out of control because I had ignored it and hadn't taken care of it when I could. And now I was hurt and other people were hurt around me. And so take it from me. Ignoring conflict is not a solution to conflict. You've got to take care of conflict when it pops up in your life. And so I'm now much faster to do this. I'm not as afraid about making things awkward and dealing with this because I've seen the problems that crop up when you ignore it. And when Jesus talks about this kind of one-on-one conflict resolution in Matthew 18, he doesn't give like a long list of how to do this because it's not that complicated. It just involves going to the person who's hurt you or who's fighting you and saying, hey, you've hurt me. And then you explain why, and you wait for them to apologize. And when they apologize, you forgive them and you move on in relationship with them. Which means that if you're pulled aside by someone who's in this situation, you need to turn the defensive dial and the justification dial way down. Because at this point, this isn't really a right or wrong problem. The problem is that one of your brothers or sisters has traced a harm and a hurt in their life back to you. Which means you probably need to apologize first and process later. And then you move forward in relationship with them. Now, some of you have tried this before And so you're saying, well, that doesn't always work. That's a little too clean. You could put that in a children's storybook and it might play. But in the real world, I'm not sure that always works. And you're right. Sometimes people laugh at you. Sometimes people defend themselves. Sometimes people fight you. They don't apologize and there is no resolution. This is why Paul starts talking about bringing a wise person in to help solve the situation. Because sometimes you do need to bring a wise person in the church in to help you solve the conflict and resolve it. And look, when you bring a wise person in, you're not looking for reinforcements for your perspective. You want to bring in someone who's unbiased. Your mom might be wise, but she's not unbiased. And so she's not the person to bring in when you've got conflict. No, you want to bring in someone who has enough credibility with both of you so that when they say what the problem is and make a suggestion, you both who are in conflict will agree with that decision and will move on. And what that means is that you may need to be open to the possibility that they're going to tell you that you're the one who's in the fault. Because this sometimes happens. In the best of times, it's hard to see ourselves rightly. In the best of times, we've got blind spots. But when we get into conflict, those blind spots increase by an order of magnitude to the point that we're like 18-wheelers going down the road with little dentist mirrors attached to the side. Like, we can't see ourselves rightly. And so we need someone else to come in and tell us what the problem actually is, and it might be you. And in that case, you have to be the one to apologize and to move forward in relationship. This has happened to me before, just recently. Elizabeth, my wife, and I were going around and around on something, couldn't seem to arrive at resolution for it. So I went to someone who knows and loves both of us, and I told him what was going on. And you know, to be honest, I kind of expected him to take my side, tell me that I was in the right and we need to fix Elizabeth, which is not usually a good way of thinking about these things. But he had the wisdom to look at me and he said, you know, I think you're trying to fix something that doesn't need to be fixed. And so you need to stop trying to control Elizabeth and you need to listen to her. Ouch. I stood up a little straighter. But you know what? I said, okay. And I went back to Elizabeth that night and I apologized for being the problem. And I told her that I was going to listen to her more when it came to this. And we were able to start working through that together. You need someone in your life who can give you that kind of hard advice. It might be a grow group member or a grow group leader or a table leader, a serve team leader, a wise person in the church, a staff member. We want to help you resolve your conflict. But you do need to probably go to a person. I wouldn't have needed to say that more than 2 years ago. But as I've worked with young adults over the last 2 years here at FaithBridge and in other places, I've noticed something interesting happening. That when conflict crops up, they're not always going to a person first. Instead, they're going to an AI first. To ChatGPT, to Claude, to Gemini. And so that may not be what you're doing, but I'm pretty sure the young people in your life are doing this, and what starts among the young people usually finds its way into the older people. Here's why I'm not sure this is a wise way to resolve conflict. AI is not a Christian. AI does not have the Holy Spirit. AI is not trained on Christian data, meaning that even if you ask AI to give you a Christian perspective on the conflict that you have, it's just going to give you normal secular advice dressed up in Christianese, in Christian language. The second reason that I don't think that this is wise is that when you have people in your life who look at a situation like this, they may give you hard advice that challenges you and develops you. But an AI does not want to challenge you or develop you. It wants to engage you, meaning it's usually not going to push back. It's usually going to tell you that you're right because that's what keeps you coming back for more. And if it pushed back and told you that you're in the wrong, you might just close your computer and say, dumb robot, you don't know me. No, you need a person who can come into your life when you can't solve conflict and speak truth that sometimes hurts, that will help you put that conflict away and take care of it. You need a person who will give you that kind of advice. And you also need a person who will give you the kind of countercultural advice that Paul gives us at the end of this passage. Look at verse 6 or verse 7. To have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? But you yourselves wrong and defraud, even your own brothers. And so Paul repeats the problem that people are in conflict and they are then suing each other over the conflict. Now, Roman courts were different than our courts today. They weren't so interested in justice. They were really interested in patronage and catering to the rich and the elite. That's a little bit different than our court system today. But that difference being said, we do live in a litigious society. And when it comes to conflict, especially economic conflict, I think many of us are way too fast to think about lawsuits against another believer, individual believer, as the solution to conflict. And I think we all probably need to slow walk that a little bit. And if you're going to sue someone, you better make sure that you've taken every possible step for resolution that you could before, that you've gone to them, that you've brought your pastor in, their pastor in. If they're at a different church, maybe you go to a Christian arbitration practice that can help you resolve the conflict. Because the problem with filing a lawsuit against somebody is that you basically foreclose the possibility of relationship with them later on. When you sue someone, you're saying the relationship is over. And for Paul, the unity of believers, whether they're a part of this church, Faithbridge, or other churches, is important because our ability to live at peace with other believers shows that we are different from the rest of the world, which can't live in peace with each other. And so when we show that we actually can't live in peace with other believers, we don't look any different than the rest of the world. This is why Paul actually suggests that if you're in conflict that doesn't seem to be resolving itself, you may need to actually do something countercultural. This is what he says. Why not rather suffer wrong? Why not rather be defrauded? What he's saying is that when conflict comes and it doesn't stop, you may need to surrender so that Jesus can win. And I hear what you're thinking. I hear what you're saying. That's not fair and that's not reasonable. And I would agree with you. What Paul's saying is not fair, and it is not reasonable. But Paul is not looking at what is fair or reasonable by the standards of the world. Paul is looking at things from the perspective of the cross, and the cross is also not fair and not reasonable. It is not fair that an innocent man, Jesus, took your sins onto himself on the cross and took the penalty that you deserved onto himself so that you could live. It is not fair that you now get to stand before the throne of grace with confidence in the presence of God now and forever because Jesus cut himself off from the presence of God to become a bridge for you and me to walk into that presence. That is not fair. And so the cross is neither fair nor is it reasonable, but it is powerful. And Paul never wants to close off the possibility that God might want to do something powerful and unexpected through a cross-shaped life. This is what I've learned even this week. Because here's what I know about a message like this. As soon as I said the word conflict at the beginning of this message, you had a name and a face that came to mind. You have a name and a face that you're in conflict with. I know that because I did as I started writing this sermon. And it was Jay, my friend from mock trial. After our senior year, Jay didn't stop coming after me. He would continue to post about me. He continued to text me a couple times a year. And in those texts, he would remind me how much he hated me. And he would always say something like, "And every problem in the world can be traced back to narcissistic men like you." And I would just delete it because what is he talking about? Like now I'm the aggrieved party. And so I've been thinking of my relationship with Jay as though he's the one who needs to come in and apologize to me. But as I sat down to write this message on Monday morning, Jay's name and face kept popping in front of my mind. And I felt like God was stopping me from writing. I couldn't get words out. I couldn't get ideas on the page. And as I was praying about it, I realized that God was calling me to surrender and to apologize to Jay. So I texted him on Monday night, and I said this: "Hi, Jay. This is Michael McDowell. Hey, I've been doing a lot of teaching on conflict resolution, and I felt convicted over the way our relationship ended. And based on the last several texts you sent me, I know that you think poorly of me, but I wanted to apologize for the way I hurt you. I lacked a lot of maturity in college, and I did not know how to handle conflict in any kind of healthy way, and that lack of emotional maturity hurt you. I am very, very sorry. I prayed today for you, for your career, and your life, and I hope you're doing well." And you know, as soon as I sent that text, I felt so much freedom and so much lighter than I had before. I didn't even know that I was carrying the weight from that conflict on my shoulders. But no matter what happened, whether he texted back or not, I now felt like I had done my part. I had done what God had called me to do, and I had surrendered. I woke up the next morning, and I was surprised to see a flurry of texts from Jay. And my heart dropped, because I felt that I was about to just read a bunch of hateful texts all over again. So I started reading, and he said this: "Hey, Michael, your message means a lot to me. Seriously, I still think about you and admire your faith genuinely. I thought a good amount about those college things, and I really don't blame you. I just think you were caught in an odd situation. That being said, I still stand on the fact that I was also put in an impossible situation. I don't resent you at all, and this message is true to form of what I think of you as a well-meaning person. But seriously, I harbor no ill will, and I hope you don't think ill of me because of my behavior either. I have many actions that I regret, and I consider any hatchet long since buried. And my only regret is that we didn't get a chance to work together more in college." Never underestimate the power of the cross. Never underestimate the power of Jesus to do something unexpected through a life that is lived in the shape of the cross. I decided to lay down my right to be right and surrender earlier this week, and God brought to an end a 6-year-long conflict. And I think he wants to do the same for you this morning. And so here's what we're gonna do. We're going to pray together now. And I would ask that you stay during this moment, because I think that whatever it is that God wants to do in your life, that's gonna happen now. And so we're gonna start even now by praying for that name and face that you had. Would you bow your head? And would you pray now for that person? And even if it's painful, would you pray that God would bless their life and their family and their career? But Paul's not wanting us to keep this in the prayer realm. Paul, as we've talked about, expects us to take care of it. And so would you tell God right now what you're going to do to take care of this conflict? If you need to pull out your phone even and send a text asking if they can talk later, feel free to do that. But tell God what you're going to do, even if it means that you're surrendering, even if it means that you're giving up your right to be right so that Jesus can win. The cross is neither fair nor is it reasonable. And so would you now stand and let's sing together, reminding ourselves of the fact that the cross is not fair and it is not reasonable, but it is powerful. Let's sing.